Welcome to the FinTech Newscast. Hit subscribe to keep up to date with the latest in FinTech news. Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John. Today we'll be talking about European tech companies and some of the reasons why they don't become the giants that Google and Facebook become. Also, the open banking API that's contributed to interoperability within banks starting in the UK, but also coming to the rest of the EU. And also online lending being banned in China. With me today is Monica.
Hey, John.
Hey, and Steve.
Hey, everyone.
All right, so Europe, why aren't tech companies from Europe getting to be massive like they do here in the US?
Well, it's a good question, and it's one that a reporter with Bloomberg asked. So there's an article up around the kind of history and current factors of the way technology startups grow in Europe. And the article actually poses a somewhat provocative point that, you know, Europe has some amazing advantages that most other places in the world would kill to have. They have amazing universities. Their cities are generally considered extremely livable with wonderful transit, things that tech workers are typically known to value. And the EU, as a common market, actually has twice the population of the US. But this hasn't really translated into kind of the huge, everybody knows your name tech company since about Nokia fell off the map.
Yeah, that sounds like they have every kind of advantage resource to do that.
I mean, great universities, fantastic transit, that's doing better than Silicon Valley is.
It's true, yeah.
So what's getting in the way? This article posits the notion that there has been a certain lack of ambition for European tech startups to take on the biggest markets, to expand really aggressively, and that one of the outcomes of that is that a lot of promising technology companies end up selling either their entire selves or a substantial stake to larger companies.
Yeah, I was surprised at the example that they had there. It had like 15,000 employees, so they have the resources and the capabilities to grow. I was kind of wondering why.
Absolutely.
Why
so
not?
I do want to talk a little bit more about that specific example because I do think it's extremely illustrative of this point. There is another thing. While Europe does have the advantage of universal regulations for certain sectors, you know, as long as you're a part of the European Union, you're governed by the European Union's laws instead of all different 28 countries.
Which are much more consumer friendly than the ones in the US.
Yes, absolutely.
Protective, you mean?
Right.
More consumer friendly. Perhaps than business friendly. However, that does not change the fact that ultimately, if you're going to be doing a consumer business in Europe, you do have to sell between to different languages and cultures. And so that actually is a disadvantage that the EU has compared to, say, the US and China, where you may certainly have regional differences in those very large countries, but in terms of what language people are speaking and kind of just the general culture, there's a lot more.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think of that. Yeah. So the common rules, but you have to translate everything into 20 plus languages.
Right, right. So basically, if you have a fintech in Germany, it'll be hard to sell to people in the UK or in Norway
or
Spain.
That's exactly it. They actually quote a venture capitalist, Harry Nellis, and the quote is, "You could be the number one company in Germany, but in France, people won't have heard of you." So if you think about, if you applied that kind of thinking to the way it works in the US, it's unlikely that you would be kind of the number one operator in, let's say, New York, and no one in Connecticut knows who you are.
Right.
So it's easier with the universal rules, but the culture is and language is the big barrier.
Yeah. So even while there are some structural factors and cultural factors that have inhibited countries, this article does point out that the US and China have had some recent stumbles in their technology environments that might actually give Europe a chance to kind of get in there. And what are those? Well, in China's case, China's having a pretty hard time exporting a lot of its products that are incredibly successful within China, but aren't necessarily as robust once they leave.
Which is the reason why we don't have things like Alipay in the US or and financial and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's not to say that we won't. It's just saying that, you know, China's having a hard time making that transition. And then, of course, when we look at the U.S., well, we've had a couple of what the article calls unforced errors with regards to fake news and privacy handling. So that's something that's interesting to think about. So now let's talk about selling out early. So funding has typically been a lot harder to come by in Europe than it has in the US and China. And
I think we talked about this right in the last episode. We discussed that basically something like 80% of all funding in the world goes to the US or China. So
of the VC funding?
Of the VC funding, right. So that leaves 20% for Africa, Latin America, Europe.
Yeah, so last year, 3,500 European companies got about $19 billion in venture investment. China, it's $40 billion, and America, $67 billion. Nonetheless, that did represent a record for European venture capitalists raising, so good for them.
Yeah, I saw it's four times what it was 5 years ago. So it was really
it's growing from a tiny number.
Right. It's ramping up, but the pie is still a lot smaller than its other rivals. So you have more venture capital coming in, but there has been a lot of pressure for firms just to kind of make their cash flow the way they need it to grow. And also, sometimes they have this insane idea of wanting to do right by their investors and giving them money to cash out.
What?
Can you imagine? I know that's very far out of favor, but it is something that has been in play in the European market. So, in these cases, sometimes companies will sell a substantial portion. The poster child for this is what John was referencing earlier, Booking.com. So Booking.com was started in Amsterdam. It has 17,000 employees. And if the company were independent, its market value would probably be higher than $50 billion. They currently generate about almost $8 billion of annual revenue. But the thing is that Booking.com sold to Priceline a number of years ago because it was desperate for money to keep growing at the time. And now it generates about 80% of Priceline's $11 billion in annual revenue.
Good for Priceline.
So the American capitalist came in and swooped in to take the means of production.
Yeah. And so all of that revenue isn't really kind of going to kind of Europe's kind of mental book. It's getting transported over to the U.S. And that's a really substantial portion. So actually, Priceline has changed its name to Booking Holdings, Inc.
That's a very catchy name. Extremely catchy name.
Yeah. So that's there are lots of other examples that are similar to that, but none quite on that scale. And
so they sold out too early, and they didn't scale up and stay European. And that's been the story with a few companies, I guess it was saying.
Huh? Yeah, and I wasn't planning on kind of going into depth on all of those, but I do want to note just a couple of other factors that play into kind of the historical reasons for why Europe may not have as much of these big companies, but also talk about some of the things that might actually be changing that. So London has historically been a startup hub for fintech for sure, but also for Europe generally. And it's been considered one of the best places to start a fintech company. And one of the reasons why is what we talked about with regards to the regulation. If you are regulated by a European Union financial authority, you can go operate in those 28 countries. However, with Brexit about to happen, and however ugly or hard or soft it will be, it's not really known what effect that will have on the London scene, but you can expect for some of those jobs to at least migrate within Europe. There's not necessarily a reason for them to leave the EU all in. The other things that this article mentions are the competitive advantage that Europe has in a couple of different areas that are not necessarily particularly focused on fintech, but they are places where Europe can parlay some of its other existing specialties and tie them to whatever technology development they want to do. Genomics, material science, drug development, these are some of the examples. And the other item that I personally think is very interesting to consider as we move forward is the regulatory environment. Aside from the universality, that we've already addressed, but the regulatory environment within the EU in terms of consumer protections is very different. So we've already talked on this podcast about the General Data Protection Regulation that just kicked in May, and that applies to all companies having any online presence that's available to any European citizen. So that can really provide a little bit of a different paradigm in terms of the way technology companies approach how they handle data, what data is for, the control and the ownership that you give to your customers. So if you look at the kind of the continuum of data protection, you have Europe very much alone on one side, China probably most likely on the furthest end of the other side of the continuum with their state involvement in security and web censorship.
Yeah, I heard an interview with Xi Jinping a few days ago where he mentioned that their model for the internet would be to have sort of a top-down state-mandated model for the internet. It's kind of an interesting way to see how each country approaches the way that they will grow their internet economy. And I think that you make a good point by saying that Europe will be somewhat in the middle. I wonder, from a European perspective, will also the fact that they tend to have heavier regulations also hinder some of the growth that we may see in startups?
So, I mean, I think that depends on what is the model of growth, right? So if you're looking for growth at all costs and shareholder value above all else, then yes, privacy regulations and data control for your customers really get in the way. If you are looking at something that's more around how do we ensure that not just financial technology products, but any products that are being offered actually have to abide by some regulations, hopefully provide some good and utility to their customers, and are profitable for corporations and companies. I mean, that does not sound like a terrible outcome to me.
Good thing that sentence wasn't any longer. So about a 0% chance that China adopts the GDPR for consumer
zero.
Protection.
Essentially zero. Yeah.
But a lot of American companies, aren't they more or less adopting GDPRs?
I thought the argument is that, yeah, because a lot of US-based companies like Facebook and Google have to abide by EU rules in order to operate in this market.
Or say they will anyway.
Right.
Say they will. They're saying they will, just like they're saying they're not tracking your location when you've told them not to track your location.
Thanks, Google.
So,
So yeah, I mean, I think it's early days for GDPR, so we don't really know exactly what it's going to look like. And one of the things that has already been a pushback for tech companies is that the phrasing that they're using in terms of the choices that consumers have is quite frankly, in my opinion, misleading and doesn't necessarily present the choice that you have around data collection in the baldest light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough. I can't wait to be 80 selecting through 500 options and then interact in different ways to have a certain setting.
And maybe by then, our faces will have changed so much that the facial recognition technology won't work anymore.
Yeah. Or somebody can just take a 3D scan of your face and break into your account that way.
Can't wait.
Nothing will be private.
So the only other thing that I do want to mention that this article throws out is there could potentially be something like the Ek effect. And Daniel Ek is the founder of Spotify. Spotify is one of the few homegrown, big-name consumer product startups.
Swedish,
yeah. And they talked about when Bjorn Borg won Wimbledon, like tons of Swedish kids went out and learned how to play tennis. So maybe Spotify will be something that teaches a whole new generation to pick up their coding fingers and code.
Start tapping away. Yeah.
Yeah. Clack, 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 clack.
Clack, 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 clack. Yeah, do it.
Yeah, the US and China could use some competition. And turns out to be, and you get better products that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's kind of what's going on at a high level across the European startup ecosystem, but we've got some more to talk about in depth.
Yeah, Europe is definitely making some moves to make things easier for fintechs to interact with large companies. And this is exactly to your point, something that facilitates startups getting access to large amounts of customers at large financial institutions. One of these, and actually it illustrates your point in a lot of ways, even the negative part. There's this open banking API that's come out in the UK, And this is an API that the top banks in the UK have to comply with so that any provider that meets the requirements can interact with those banks and offer products to their customers. So if you're a small company and you meet the security and the connectivity requirements, you can start marketing and offering things that access your account, actually. And of course, the security level is very high to avoid any issues, but it makes it much easier for people to offer new ideas and new technology and to compete with the large banks with a common interface across, well, the industry is what they're aiming for. But what reminds me about what you were saying about, you know, a lot of the tech companies coming from the U.S., getting bigger is the company that does the testing software for providers that want to provide services through this open banking API is called ForgeRock. They have a test environment for this open banking API, and that company is based in San Francisco.
Look at that.
Yay.
So Silicon Valley's trying to snatch that pie again
and selling the new version of a shovel.
That's right.
In the next
exactly.
Bull rush.
They're not.
EU branded.
They actually offer the test environment for free, but of course it's selling their services and their brand and a lot of other things.
So I wonder, does the article go into any details as to how is there more competition or is it just sort of same old, same old?
Well, it just started. It was supposed to start as of January of 2018, and there's been some delay while they work out some of the bugs. There's actually been not that many companies. They just mentioned one specifically that started connecting and offering services. It's not been a huge land rush as of yet, but you know, I don't know what's going on in the background, how many companies are testing and haven't released. They didn't give any numbers on that. But it's not just the UK that's offering this kind of open connectivity environment. The EU has something called the PSD2 that's also a standard set of APIs. Yeah, very tech.
Oof,
we put the tech back in fintech.
Yeah.
Well, this isn't the marketing podcast for sure. Yeah. So that's the Revised Payment Service Directive, PSD2.
It's the second one, I think.
Yes,
I'm pretty sure it's the second one.
Yeah, yep. So that's the EU's version of the Open Banking API. So again, like you were saying, this common environment across the EU to increase competition, and at least this one's behind the scenes. So maybe language and culture won't hinder money flows.
Yeah,
because it's all euros.
I'd be interested to know how the big banks in Europe feel about this, if they consider it kind of encroaching on their turf.
It's interesting. Yeah.
So it's welcome.
Yeah, they mentioned one or two ways that maybe the large banks are asking for extra requirements and testing before they but I think eventually they'll have to comply. And but of course they're throwing in roadblocks here and there.
Right. So both PSD or PDS2, PSD2?
R2D2.
PSD2,
right,
the
EU one, yes.
So both PSD2 and open banking in the UK were our government mandated regulations. And I think that if something similar were to come to the US and kind of bring it back here to the US market, it's very unlikely to pass because it's not sort of the way we do the business here in the US. So, and I think there's
it's too consumer friendly.
It's
too hard on the banks.
Yeah.
It would never fly.
Exactly.
And it's so sad and depressing that we all seem to agree that.
Yeah. I would place the likelihood of something like this coming to the US at between nil and zero, basically, to have a government mandated open banking API, I think.
And I think
we did just
prove the little privacy continuum, privacy and innovation continuum point.
Yeah.
Because I don't think China's going to go for this necessarily either.
Yeah, you think? Yeah.
Yeah, probably not.
Well, we did have something like that, I guess. And then I'm remembering back to the telecommunications deregulation, where all the baby bells had to provide.
Where AT&T was broken up.
They had to have co-location and interconnectivity with small competitors. They had to allow people competitors to put their equipment alongside the AT&T in or Pacific Bell or wherever you are, that baby bell, and let them connect and offer services.
But if we have to get to the point where we're breaking up Ma Bell and well, that was something that's consumer friendly and business friendly, right? This is the thing about near monopolies or monopolies is they're not actually good for the business either. Like that business doesn't become a better business by being monopolistic. It just gets rents.
Yeah. So they had to be forced through this law to provide co-location and that's why you have things like telephone number portability.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a contractor at an AT&T Baby Bell in the mid to late 90s. And I actually
1890s?
Worked. It feels like, some days, some mornings. So they had to offer their competitors connectivity with the overall network. So because otherwise there's no way that a lot of competitors are going to, and we didn't want a parallel set of phone lines everywhere.
Isn't also the reason why our internet here in the U.S. sucks and it's expensive is because the pipes are not being shared, so you can't have
competitors. Right. Yeah. I know in Japan, I don't know about the, I know in France too, that they share a line and then any company can come and...
Right.
Whereas here in the U.S., you still have phone companies owning the phone lines, and they do still have co-location requirements, which is why you have these smaller DSL startups. But of course, your Comcast and your Time Warners don't, which is why they don't have to share their cable service with any competitors.
Right.
That's why. But if the FCC is listening, let's just add that to your really long to-do list.
Please.
Yeah. First, reversing everything from the past 2 years.
Right.
And then, so one big bank that is offering something that's been made possible by the PSD2 is HSBC. And they offer an iOS app as of May of 2018 called Connected Money that shows your savings, mortgage accounts, and checking balances from up to 21 different banks in just one app.
So like a Mint or a Personal Capital.
Do they do that? How do they get all the data from all the... You just log in?
Screen scraping in most cases.
Screen scraping?
Yeah, it's either screen scraping or APIs if they have it. But basically, once you give them your credentials, they go and log in as if they were you. And then they get the information and then present it to you via the app.
So you don't have to have an API?
You don't. I think the companies, the industry is moving away from screen scraping, which is sort of not super safe, and going more towards the API model. But yeah, that's the model they use now.
Why do they call it screen scraping?
Because they scrape us on the screen. So they scrape your balances, your transactions, and they use your login for that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay. But yeah, it's a data feed. When I think screen scraping, I think like they're taking a screenshot or something.
It's basic. It's almost that. It's not. It's a little smarter than that, but they basically go in and have a machine read your balance and read your...
It's not very smart in terms of... So that creates the security issue?
It creates an issue, and it's also not entirely up to date. So I think it's delayed by at least a few minutes. So
okay.
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, that's interesting. So an API like this... probably has the security requirements you would want.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
And certainly, and I didn't mean to minimize what HSBC is offering, because HSBC is a truly global bank on a scale that many others are not, whereas I think Mint and Personal Capital, they are for the most part targeting the U.S. market.
So this kind of ability, this open API, it's not just viewing data. It creates the capability for people to automate services or be creative and possibly offer new services. They're looking at things like having automated accounting services, tax reporting and filing, access to capital. If you allow access to a lender and they can see some of your financial information, they can make a better lending decision or possibly offer you more.
Maybe even a faster lending decision, right? Anything that can speed
up
the loan process
is welcome. Yeah,
because it's digital.
It's right away.
Yeah.
And there's less risk because they're seeing what's actually happened. They can have real-time access to your account instead of filing paperwork. So a lot of paperwork elimination. They can automate calculations and things like that, especially something like taxes. And possibly... lots of other services that we haven't invented yet. So ForgeRock offers something called the Open Banking Directory, and this gives fintechs the ability to get approval from the regulator because they can test and certify that they comply and with these new APIs. So one of the companies that came up during this week, actually, in the news is Deposit Solutions. And this was in the headline, they mentioned Peter Thiel as one of the funders of this company. And they use the Open Banking API and the European version of it, PSD2, in order to provide just what we're saying, these creative new services.
And I had to read this article really slowly to make sure I actually understood the service that Deposit Solutions is offering.
Do they offer deposit solutions?
They do, actually. Yeah. You could say it solves a problem. And much in the way that a swap derivative would do. And you're exchanging your profile with somebody else.
The swap derivative to me is not going to be easier to understand than what they're actually doing.
Please explain.
Maybe a step-up note would be easier. So the example that they have in the article was pretty good, I thought. So let's play that out, actually. So Monica, you're Monica Bank.
Excellent.
And you are cheap.
Yeah.
You have more deposits than you know what to do with, and you offer, so you only offer 0.2% interest on people that deposit with you.
That's right, because I'm cheap.
Thank you, Monica. Yeah. And Steve, you're cash starved. You're maybe a commercial lender or a wholesale bank, something like that, and you don't have a lot of branches, so you can't really reach out, and you're not going to build out a whole branch structure, but you need capital,
mm-hmm.
and your large financial institution, it could be anything, insurance company, but you can get funding now through Deposit Solutions, acting as a middleman, connecting Monica's, which has an abundance of deposits, and Steve, who is cash starved. So Steve can offer his 5% interest rate to Monica Bank's customers.
My customer is thrilled because instead of 0.2%, they're getting 5%.
And I as a bank, I'm thrilled because I'm getting my money out there and having my money earn money for me.
Exactly. So, and the customer doesn't have to open a new account with every new bank that raises their interest rates. They can stay with Monica Bank, and since Monica's connected with all the other financial institutions, she can offer the highest interest rates to her customers and without any large overhead and protecting her brand at the same time.
And so my customer is thrilled.
Exactly.
And my customer does not go open up another account with another institution just to get a higher rate.
Right, so they don't chase hot money, as they say, from bank to bank.
So when I read this article, I thought, oh my God, is this the holy grail of a win, win, win?
Yes. Yes. Well, it certainly makes the market more efficient, right? Matching people who need money, who are willing to pay more for it, with someone who wants the best rate that they can get.
I can't wait to see what's wrong with it, but so far it sounds great.
Too good to be true.
Yeah, well, maybe, or just maybe making the market more efficient. When some new products came out, swaps, like we said, it definitely made the market more efficient. It took risk away from people who didn't want it and gave it in a very transparent, seamless way to people who did and maybe could afford to take that risk if used properly. Derivatives are not a cure-all.
Not child's play.
If you hedge, they're fine. If you speculate, you can buy Bitcoin also. So there's a lot of advantages. And maybe it's just one of those things that it just wasn't possible until these common APIs made these connections between these banks secure, real-time, and easy to use. Deposit Solutions definitely couldn't exist without writing on top of that improved infrastructure and connectivity between the financial institutions. So far, it looks like a win-win. So Deposit Solutions is based in Germany. They're still pretty small, but they did just raise $100 million. And Peter Thiel was actually not in this latest funding round, but they throw his name in there since he's the most well-known.
Oh, got it. So he already invested, and it's like, oh, Peter.
So they're using the name, exactly. Peter. So from Germany, we're going all the way to China, where things are going, what, in the other direction, would
they're
you say?
They're going kind of sideways, yeah. So I'm sure that both of you are familiar with the Chinese social ranking system, right? The system where basically if you don't pay your loans, you can't book train tickets.
If you jaywalk,
you're publicly shamed.
If you say Xi Jinping looks like Winnie the Pooh, which I am not saying. I am not saying that. But if somebody said that.
And what year is it? 1984?
Yeah. It's actually 1983 and a half. The system hasn't really gone into effect yet. So China, for the past like 3 or 4 years or so, has seen this tremendous growth in P2P lending. So companies like Lending Club and Prosper in the U.S., but Chinese. So they went, so in 2015, they had, I think, 3,500 online platforms for lending, which is insane. And it's a lot of companies. And that's, of course, it's a huge market, but it's based on the fact that they didn't really have a good credit system in place.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a good way for small businesses or even individuals to get access to liquidity. So because of that, we had this tremendous growth in the P2P lending space. Well, not anymore. The Chinese government has announced recently, as of mid-August, that they're going to place more scrutiny on online lendings. And some analysts from Citibank predict that the number will go from 3,500 to 200 in the next 2 years or so.
Ooh,
which is a precipitous drop.
Shakeout.
Exactly. Huge shakeout.
They don't wait for the market to shake things out. Huh?
They don't.
They don't want that kind of disruption.
They don't. And apparently there's been real life implications to some of the closures we've seen already in the P2P space. So stores have shut down. People have been sort of, people have lost their money as well. So
a convenience store chain got caught up in this and basically went out of business.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of embedded in some funny places.
It is.
Do we know what happens? So if your P2P lender goes out of business, if I loaned Steve money, does Steve have to pay me back?
I think because they were unregulated, I think you're SOL.
Mm.
And what does that stand for? Sino. Overlending.
Sino overlending. That's.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So well, it sounds like any place where the economy grows fast and everybody jumps into the market, where there's a quick return and a quick buck, and there's no regulation, and now unlike in the U.S. and Western countries where we just wait for the economy to collapse into a burning mass of bad loans. So China, being a one-party totalitarian state, can just say, no.
It's over.
This is going to stop happening before that crisis occurs.
Right. And the analyst from the article, the analyst from Citi, mentioned that there's sort of three reasons why there was this rash of failures. One is that there was a tightening in the macro credit environment.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that there was a lot of compliant costs given the new regulations. So the companies were less likely to actually go ahead and become compliant with what the Chinese government insisted.
They didn't want to stop doing their business, making money also.
Exactly, yeah. And the third is that there was sort of a rash of withdrawals as well. So people were really rushing to get their money out of the platforms. And because the companies were undercapitalized, a bunch of them went under, and more will do as well.
Oh, so the market was starting to take a bite early on.
Yeah.
Well, I'm certainly familiar with articles on the macro side of it, where the Beijing government has trying to reduce the overextended borrowing
mm-hmm.
not just on the personal level, but from municipalities,
yeah.
large cities that
State
are over borrowing
to some degree.
Right, trying to rein in that credit. And there's certainly good students of what's happened in other places that have caused problems. I mean, they always reference the Soviet Union and
right.
what collapsed there. And this is probably more of a Japan example of
right.
And the U.S. more recently, of what can happen if you don't step in.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
What I do think is interesting here is we've talked a couple of times about the fact that China does not have yet a functional credit rating system,
mm-hmm.
and that really is inhibiting some of its consumer-focused lending. So if you think about, you probably don't need 3,500 players in this market, but if you had maybe 50 or 75 in a market as large as China.
It's a billion plus people. It's
right. Market, yeah. That smaller number of firms, they would begin to have a good sense of some of the history, credit history type items
mm-hmm.
for the people doing business on their platform. But that's still not a substitute for something that is as imperfect as our FICO scores.
Right. Well, hopefully this will be resolved once they, you know, actually come through with their social scoring system.
Yeah.
And that becomes a thing.
Ugh, I don't want a social score, though.
That's much worse, isn't it?
Financial score. Financial score, not social score.
Yeah, yeah. It's a political score, really. Settling political scores will be literal.
Literal, yeah.
Yeah, sounds like a Black Mirror episode.
Sounds downright dystopian, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do want to be clear, I think all of us actually go through the world and are generally attempting to be nice, right?
Like, don't be a jerk. Seems to be a good rule, yeah. Don't be a jerk.
And yet this still gives us like pause and makes us think, oh God, what if I had to live my financial life tied to a social score?
I'd be homeless, yeah.
I mean, I also wonder, you know, say that you miss a payment, so then you have a lower score. And then now you can get a better loan, so you get a kind of a shitty rate, and you have to get, you know, kind of default on that as well. So it's sort of a nice downward spiral to homelessness.
But that already happens under our system, and it's right. Not taking into these more social items. It's just looking at your financials.
I think Xi Jinping is quite handsome, actually. So.
And not at all like looking like a panda bear?
Winnie the Pooh? No, not at all.
Winnie the Pooh. Because you said panda the first time.
No, he did.
Got me all confused.
When he first brought that up a few years ago. Yeah.
Oh.
Sorry. Okay, so you corrected him.
At that time.
Yeah.
But you mucked up my brain. Not your fault.
Yeah, I, for one, welcome our new corporate overlords.
What's new about them?
Well, with that in mind, I think it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it.
I'll go first. So my number is 33.5 million. Care to guess what that is?
The taxes you paid last year.
Yes. No, I wish. That's actually the number of downloads that Square's P2P money transfer app Cash experienced in July. And that is in contrast with Venmo, which had 32.9 million downloads. So
is that the first time that they passed them?
That is indeed the first time that we see Square's Cash is going to overtake Venmo, which has been for at least 5 or 6 years sort of the dominant P2P money transfer app.
And Square Cash isn't even a verb.
It's not even a verb, yeah.
Me?
Yeah, Square Cash me.
Is there a close third, or is it just these guys and then everyone else is
way
behind?
In terms of volumes or... volumes, yeah. I think Zelle maybe third, but I'm not sure.
What about PayPal?
PayPal, yeah.
PayPal right. owns Venmo.
I know, but those Venmo numbers in the article are Venmo only. They don't.
Oh, that
PayPal
is a good point. I don't know. Yeah, yeah. I know that for every transaction that we do on Venmo, they lose money. So, good for them.
Good for them. Well, they're getting market. They'll make it up in volume.
They'll make some volume. Don't worry. Exactly. Yeah,
they'll be fine. All right, my final bite is 2020, and this is the year in which banks will claim less than 50% of payments revenue. So the Venmos, the Cash, the Apple Pays, the PayPals of the world will make more revenue than these non-bank players, but will make more revenue than the banks starting in 2020.
This is only for money transfers, right? Not for non-interest stuff. Payments,
yeah, right. So as of 2017, banks had $163 billion in revenue versus non-banks, which were at $136 billion. So it's already not that far off, and already pretty close.
And 2020 is right around the corner.
It's a year and a half away.
And if the banks don't want this to happen, they better start doing more advertising for Zelle.
So it's hopeless, basically, is what you're saying. So... the world is changing.
And our phones are our wallets.
Yeah, right.
So my final bite is 32%. And that is the proportion of the global population that Gen Z represents. And what's interesting about this number is that Gen Z is just now taking over millennials in terms of the biggest generation.
So what I want to know about this is Gen Z just the placeholder And they're going to come up with a better name than that, right? Like millennial came a bit after Gen Y and all that.
Could it be Zillennial?
Zillennial? Oh.
Okay, well, first off, the I think Zell we're generation. All glad that y'all aren't on the naming committee.
And what happens after Gen Z? It'll be Gen A.
So this stat is coming out from the UN. And so the UN actually is very kind and tells you what their criteria are. So they used millennials, the generation of people born in 1983 through 2000. And then Gen Z starts kicking in from anyone born 2001 until now. So they actually haven't called the end of the Gen Z generation. They're still being born.
So if you're being born right now, we have a name for
We've
you.
We've already named you.
And this is Zed, the Tech Newscast.
Zoe.
Zachary.
Zachary's out there. Yeah.
Maybe Zebediah. I don't know.
I'm sure there is.
I'll make a comeback.
Jesus. Sure.
So part of the reason that they can take over the millennials is because every day more Gen Z are being born. With regards to the name, yeah, we'll see what happens. We're actually kind of far into the generation. We've been calling them this for a while. And of course, these guys, they are digital natives. All they've known is like iPhones and the war on terror, poor things.
Thank you for the Gen Z report, Monica. Well, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. The links to all of the articles we referenced are in our show notes. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes. And thanks again for listening.
Ciao.
Bye, Zillennials.